It is my pleasure to introduce to you Alex Schadenberg, Executive Director and International Chairperson of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. The EPC's goal is to build a well-informed, broadly based membership of groups and individuals in order to establish an effective social barrier to euthanasia and assisted suicide. Alex has become known as the definitive source of information on issues relating to euthanasia and assisted suicide, as seen in his book entitled Exposing Vulnerable People to Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. His topic, Coalition Building, the Data and Talking Points Needed to Defeat the Assisted Suicide Lobby.
Now, I should have asked someone how I'm supposed to advance my slide, but that's fine. I'm talking to you about euthanasia and assisted suicide, and many of you are probably only been involved in pro-life in the sense of dealing with the beginning of life, which is an incredibly important thing to be involved in. But the fact of it is that in the United States, we've been facing a major onslaught by the assisted suicide lobby. In Canada, we've even faced a worse onslaught. But the fact is in the United States, you have assisted suicide that's been legal in Oregon since 1988. It was in place. 1998 it was in place. And then now in Washington State, it's been in place since 2009, Vermont more recently, and then most recently California, which is just a shock to us that such a large state would go down that, how would you say, that trap, that hole. But the fact of it is this is a worldwide movement going on right now to push assisted suicide and euthanasia. In my own country, the Supreme Court struck down our old law last February, on February 6, 2015, and they are now talking about legalizing euthanasia. A committee just came out with a report just a couple weeks ago saying that euthanasia should be allowed for minors, for people with dementia, for people with psychiatric conditions. Doctors would have to refer. They would not be given the moral right just to say, I won't be involved. They also said that hospitals would have to participate, even if they're religiously affiliated. That's a pretty radical idea to go that far, and yet that's where my country seems to be where it wants to go. So I'm going to talk about this. You're going to be facing a major onslaught. Last year, there was 25 states that attempted to legalize assisted suicide in the U.S. last year alone. This year, they've gone for about 10 states. What's happening, though, is there seems to be a bit of a lull this year, that the assisted suicide lobby in 2016 slowed down a bit because they're getting ready for 2017 after the election. There's going to be a major, major push. If you weren't aware about this issue becoming the issue to be faced politically in the next few years, this is it. Whether you like it or not, this issue of assisted suicide is going to be the political issue. And the other side is attempting to steamroll us. My PowerPoint is not up yet, which is interesting enough. I'm to hit the green button. Oh, there we go. Now it goes on. That's really good. I like that. Oh, there it goes. So I'm going to start by telling you this story. In June 2015, during a press conference in Belgium, this psychiatrist who works with the euthanasia clinic in Belgium had just published a study, and so she was doing a press conference to say, my study is being published, on her 100 first requests for euthanasia for psychiatric reasons. So this is in June of last year in Belgium. This is a psychiatrist who works with the euthanasia clinic. And what she's saying then is she's trying to explain this, and she, in order to explain why euthanasia was necessary for psychiatric reasons, she decided to talk about Laura. She wanted to give us the story of Laura. And Laura, who is Laura? Well, Laura was a 24-year-old, she's still alive, 24-year-old woman, completely healthy in every way. She's not sick, she doesn't have cancer, she doesn't have ALS. You name the condition that people are afraid of, she doesn't have it, but she experiences suicidal ideation. And in her story, she's been suicidal since the age of 7. She's attempted suicide on many occasions. And she's been going to this psychiatrist, Dr. Theobald, who is now in June of 2015 announcing she's been approved for euthanasia. Now let's think this one through. I'm not suggesting that Laura, who we now know was Emily, I'm not suggesting that she doesn't go through a type of suffering. Psychological suffering is a type of suffering. What I'm questioning is when did the treatment for suicidal ideation, which is not uncommon, become lethal injection. Could this happen in America? My own country, the report of our recent government, which we don't have legislation yet to debate, but as I said, the recent report is suggesting this could happen in my country of Canada. Now, am I missing something? It says the green button, doesn't it? Or is it just me? Oh, it is up now. So what is euthanasia? Well, most in Canada, we're talking about euthanasia. In the U.S., they're talking about assisted suicide. They're birds of a feather that flock together, but they're a little different. Euthanasia is, let's be very clear, it's not about withdrawing medical treatment. I'm not talking about care. I'm talking about treatment, per se. It's not about the proper use of pain-killing drugs. It's not about the proper use of sedation techniques. Remember, I'm talking about the proper use. Euthanasia is when one person, usually a doctor, directly and intentionally kills you. You might have requested it. It's done usually by lethal injection, but it can be done in many ways. It's always been seen as a homicide. It's always known as a homicide. In my own country, they're going to define it as medical treatment. Why is this? What am I doing wrong? Is there something wrong with me? I can't switch this flat. Am I supposed to aim, Simra? So what is assisted suicide? So as I explained, euthanasia is when I kill you. So if you want to understand euthanasia, people say, oh, well, you know, these are difficult issues. My mother was sick. My mother was nearing death, and we had to make decisions around medical treatment options and things like that. Well, to withdraw medical treatment when you're dying has got nothing to do with euthanasia. Euthanasia is when I lethally inject you or I deny you basic care. Assisted suicide is similar. Assisted suicide is when someone is directly intentionally involved with causing your death, meaning that person assists your suicide. So in the case of euthanasia, it's a lethal injection. In the case of assisted suicide, they give you the lethal dose, but technically you take it yourself. Now remember, euthanasia and assisted suicide are very similar. The only difference is how it's done. Because remember, in the case of assisted suicide, you know, sometimes the person can't physically take the lethal dose. So it becomes euthanasia because they have the lethal dose, but somebody else has to do it to them. So you understand they're actually the same thing. Assisted suicide being a little bit lesser of the same thing, but of the same degree. I just want to go to the next slide. Mark and Eddie Verbussum is the next story I want to tell you about. This is just to show you where things can go. These men were born deaf. They're identical twins. They lived together their whole life. They were 45 years old in Belgium. And in 2012, they asked for euthanasia because they were going blind. They said if they became blind, remember they're deaf already, they had lived together their whole lives. They ran a business together. They were shoe repairmen. They had a shoe business. They decided going blind would make them dependent on others. And being dependent on others, they said, was too great a level of psychological suffering. And a psychiatrist said they agreed, and they died both by euthanasia together. Now, could this happen in the U.S.? I'm not sure. But then let's talk about the next story. In the Netherlands, in 2013, In the Netherlands in 2013, there was a case of a, this was the very first story of this, a woman who was 70 years old. She was healthy in every way. She had some aches and pains, but, you know, even our comedian who's 62 has aches and pains. But anyway, the point is she was around 70 years old, and she asked for euthanasia because she was going blind. She was nearly blind. She died by euthanasia to the euthanasia clinic. And the reason she gave was that she had an obsession with cleanliness. And she said becoming blind meant that it would be too great a level of psychological suffering not to know that everything around her was clean. Now, how many of you are Dutch? Yeah, because the Dutch people understand that one a bit, right? But I mean, the point of it is, that is not a reason to kill somebody. But of course, when euthanasia becomes legal, what's the only question left? When you legalize euthanasia, it's okay for one person to kill another person. And there's many reasons you want to ask for it. It's okay to do so. And assisted suicide is very similar. It becomes okay for a doctor to give somebody a lethal prescription. And there's many reasons one might ask for it. Well, once you've already said that's okay, the only question remaining for us to debate is under what reason? Right? It's okay for me to kill you. The only question remaining is, for what reason? My friend Amy Hasbrook, she is a disability leader in Quebec, and she was born legally blind. Now, I ask you a social question. When somebody is allowed to have euthanasia for blindness, because that's what that case was, then does that change our attitudes towards blind people? I'm only using blindness as an example, right? What about this story? It's a crazy story, but it's true. Angie was 44 years old. She had anorexia. She was seeing this psychiatrist, Dr. Van der Eyken. Dr. Van der Eyken had convinced her to establish a sexual relationship. She then complained about the situation. And in her complaint, the whole process, she said, didn't go well. She asked for euthanasia. She didn't ask for euthanasia because of anorexia. She asked for euthanasia because she said the psychological pain associated with the complaint process and the whole, what she called sexual exploitation, was so great, she could not live any longer. She died by euthanasia. Now, there's no question that Anne was suffering. There's no question that Anne was suffering. The question then becomes, how does society deal with suffering? Because once euthanasia or assisted suicide are legal, it's okay to kill people. So the question only becomes, for what reason? So you have not progressed this far in the U.S. No one in the U.S. is talking about this yet. Just for your, I'm going to give you some basic information. The woman who's the head of Compassion and Choices did a talk in in Connecticut last year. And someone asked her a question about people going through psychological pain. And she said, that is a very, very important question that we're going to deal with sometime in the future. So let's talk about what's going on in the United States. If my slide will change. So I'm going to first tell you about how the law works, and then I'll tell you some stories about it. So I think the key to this whole thing, if you want to understand how to fight euthanasia, assisted suicide, you have to know that the devil is in the details. The other side sells it as a lie. They tell you this is all about my autonomy, my choice. That's what they say it's about. They say to you, if you don't want assisted suicide, that's fine. I want assisted suicide. Therefore, don't infringe upon my freedom. It's my body, it's my choice. Have you ever heard that before? My body, my choice? No, you haven't? Okay. So the fact of it is that in Oregon and Washington State and Vermont, how the law works is they say it's about my body, my choice, my autonomy. And how it actually works is that somebody might ask to die. That's correct. They make a request. Two doctors decide. After the two doctors decide, one of them goes ahead and writes the prescription for the lethal dose once they agree. They have a short waiting period. Then after the person receives that lethal dose, there's no further oversight. The law does not require anybody to be there at the death. The law does not require any third-party intervention to make sure that the law is being followed. The law doesn't require any of that. What it means is once they have their lethal dose, they can take that lethal dose at any time of their choosing. Once they have died, the doctor who wrote the lethal prescription must send in a report. So let's think about this. The law works by the doctor deciding, the doctor prescribing, and after you die, the doctor sends in the report. And then they say, but Alex, there's no abuse going on in Oregon or Washington State. Well, how are you going to have any sign of any abuse when the doctor who prescribed the lethal dose is also the doctor who sent in the report? They're the ones who decided, they're the ones who wrote the prescription, they're the ones who are almost never at the death, and they're also the ones who are sending in the report. So if you were completely depressed, and your husband thought it was a good idea, don't laugh. And if that were to happen, and you weren't actually competent, would the doctor write in the report, oh, so-and-so was not competent, clearly, though, seemed to be terminal, husband definitely wanted it. No, of course the doctor's not going to write that down. The point of it is it's not actually designed to protect you. So here's a story of Barbara Wagner. Why is this story important? Because here she is, and she has recurrent lung cancer. She's been prescribed an aggressive form of medical treatment to deal with her recurrent lung cancer. So she had lung cancer. She went into remission. It came back. Her prognosis was not good, right? And the state health plan turned her down for the medical treatment. Well, that's one issue. I'm not going to tell Oregon what they have to do with what they insure. But they offered her, in turn, assisted suicide. Now, I don't know if this would happen in Ohio, but I do know in my own place called Ontario, we have a one-payer health system, and we have about a $10 billion provincial deficit. And the province pays for all our health care. Why wouldn't they do that? The point of it is it becomes coercion, doesn't it? It's a form of coercion. It's a form of coercion. And we're opening up ourselves to coercion by the government. Dr. Charles Bence wants to tell you something else. In the Oregon law, they say, well, we have safeguards. Alex, I know that there's some euthanasia of people with psychiatric conditions going on in the Netherlands and Belgium, but we don't do that in Oregon. If you look at the law, they have the one section of the law, the one line says that if there's signs of depression, you know, mental illness, the law doesn't require it, but it says they should be sent for a psychiatric assessment. It doesn't say must. It should actually have said must if they really wanted to say they're safeguard. So what happens is then they say, well, we don't do assisted suicide on depressed people in Oregon. That's what they tell you. Dr. Bence had a patient. Dr. Bence is a family physician. This was a long-term patient. He's not a walk-in clinic doctor. He had a 76-year-old long-term patient who he had diagnosed with cancer. He referred his patient to the cancer specialist. He had just recently saw his patient. He noted in the medical records his patient was very depressed. Now, is it uncommon to be depressed when you get a diagnosis of cancer? Do you know a lot of your friends probably feel very depressed when they get a diagnosis of cancer? So what happened is that he went to the oncologist, and he had asked then for assisted suicide. The oncologist calls up Dr. Bence and says, will you be the second doctor to sign the assisted suicide form? Remember, the law requires two doctors, right? And Dr. Ben says, my patient, he's the primary physician, my patient does not qualify because my patient is depressed. His patient died by assisted suicide. The doctor didn't care that Dr. Bence had said my patient is depressed. His patient was not sent off for a psychiatric assessment. His patient died by assisted suicide. What's interesting about this, when Dr. Bence wrote the story up of what happened to his patient, he wrote the story so you know that the law really is only as good as the doctor who's willing to follow the law. Right? That's all it's as good as. The doctor doesn't want to follow the law. You think the doctor wrote in the report that they sent into the government after the death? After the death? Remember, the report sent in to the government after the death. The only witness who could tell you that something wrong actually happened is dead. Right? And that's supposed to be a safeguard. Anyway, do you think the doctor wrote there, oh, the primary physician told me this patient was completely depressed and needed treatment for antidepression? Think he wrote that? No, I don't think so. Anyway, the point of it is that after he wrote this up, the doctor who actually was the doctor who gave the second opinion said, well, if I had known, I wouldn't have signed the document. But the primary physician, the oncologist knew. Jeanette Hall. Now, what's important about this story is two things. First of all, Jeanette Hall wanted assisted suicide, but she had a good doctor. She had a very good doctor. She had a doctor who believed in life. Her doctor didn't believe in assisted suicide. She in 2000, was diagnosed with cancer. She was given 6 months to a year to live. And Jeanette Hall said, I don't want treatment. I want assisted suicide. That's what she said. And her doctor said, well, you know, you come back next week and we'll do another examination. We'll talk about it. So she came back next week, and what did her doctor do? Her doctor did what a good doctor does. He talked to her and found out what was important to her. And what was important to Jeanette Hall was her son. She had a son who is in police college. And she said, and he said to her, Jeanette, wouldn't you like to see your son graduate from police college? And Jeanette said, well, of course I want to see my son graduate from police college. And he said, well, you know, if you try some non-invasive type treatments, I guarantee you're going to live long enough to see your son graduate from police college. So what he did is he convinced her to accept treatment. When she was saying, I don't want any treatment, I just want assisted suicide, she's changed her mind, she's accepting treatment. And then, you know, he did what he was supposed to do. When she was coming for treatment, he spoke to her and he talked to her. And he realized that son is not only important to her, but she lived for her son. She's very important to her. Very, very important to her life, her son. And this is the only son she has. So he said to her, well, wouldn't you like someday to see your son get married? And Jeanette said, of course I'd like to see my son get married someday. And he said, well, you know, you're reacting well to treatment. If we try, you know, further treatments, you might survive this. And in fact, she needed surgery. She needed, like, radiation. She needed significant treatment. She went into remission. Now, what's the moral of my story? Does everyone go into remission? Absolutely not. The moral of the story is the doctor cared enough about her to find out what was important to her. She was obviously depressed and concerned and had fear for her future, which is a normal human reality. And she accepted treatment. She went into remission. She's happy to be alive. Now, there's two issues here. First of all, the doctor didn't kill her or help to kill her. Secondly, there's nothing in the law in Oregon at this time forcing him to have to refer her for assisted suicide. You know what they're talking about now in Oregon? They're talking about the doctors are not responsible if they don't refer their patients to another doctor who will do the assisted suicide. They're creating pressure. They want to change the rules to say that doctors, you don't have to assist the suicide, but you're going to have to refer them to the executioner. You're going to have to do that. Well, you see, then Jen Hall would be dead if she had been referred to another doctor. She was not in any way forced to. Then there's the story of Pietro D'Amico. This is not an American story, but it is an assisted suicide story. There might be several cases like this in the U.S. No one's ever told us about one yet, though. He was an Italian, and he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He went to Switzerland. He died at the assisted suicide clinic. It cost him about 10,000 euro, a lot of money. Then in his autopsy, it showed he had a wrong diagnosis. Do wrong diagnoses happen? Do you know anybody who's ever had a wrong diagnosis? In fact, they're actually quite common. The difference is, with assisted suicide, you're dead. So let's look at some of the data. In 2015, the Oregon Assisted Suicide Report, that's the most recent report, it just came out in January for the 2015 stats, it showed that 132 people died by assisted suicide. Now, that was a 26% increase. So when they tell you, oh, well, you know, there's only a few people who will ever want this, what happens is it starts becoming culturally accepted. So the last 2 years, it went up by 26% last year, and the year before, it went up by 44%. I don't have that data there. I should have, actually. Also, one of the people, actually, that stat's wrong. I thought I corrected it. One of the patients lived 517 days. One of them who died last year lived 517 days. I thought I had edited that because that's the year before. The year before, one person had lived 1,004 days before dying by assisted suicide. Remember, what's important about that, it's supposed to be a terminal diagnosis, right? You're supposed to be within 6 months. Now, this whole thing about psychiatric evaluations, 5 people who died by assisted suicide received a psychiatric evaluation, 5 of the 132 who died, and only 14 times in the 132 deaths, the doctor who wrote the prescription was at the death. Now, what's important about that is, then what's he writing in the report? Does he actually know how you died? Could you have died by somebody else doing it to you? Is that possible? Do we know how they died? We don't know how they died. Washington State report is actually more interesting. The 2014, we don't have the 2015 report yet. The 2014 report showed 126 people reportedly died by assisted suicide. Now watch why I say reportedly. The data shows that there was a 6% increase in 2014. You say, well, that's not much, Alex. Well, the year before, there'd been a 43% increase. So, you know, over 2 years, it's about a 50% increase. That's quite a bit. According to the annual report, there was 176 lethal prescriptions written. Now, you're going to hear people say to you, Alex, there's about one-third that it's only comfort to them. They never take their lethal dose. It's only about providing comfort for them. Well, does the data actually show that? The data shows 126 people reportedly died by assisted suicide. It shows you that there were 17 deaths from other causes. 6 people remained alive. And then the data says 27 deaths from an unknown cause. Now, how can you have deaths from an unknown cause? So, you know, I do a lot of research, so I thought, well, let's see what it actually says in the report about the 27 deaths from an unknown cause. The state report said, that they do not know whether or not the 27 deaths from unknown causes resulted from assisted suicide. They just don't know. They have no data on those 27 deaths. They don't know. They know those people died. They don't know how they died. It might have been assisted suicide. It might have been natural death. They don't know. They've got no idea. They've got no report. They don't know. They don't know. Now remember, you've got doctors prescribing a lethal dose. I'm not talking about giving you a dose of painkillers that if you took it all today would kill you. I'm talking about an intentional lethal dose. They're giving this to you. And in 27 cases, they don't know how you died. They have no idea. This is supposed to be effective oversight. This is supposed to be about safeguards, right? This is supposed to be about, oh, we'll protect you. Then it said, when the status of the participant is unknown, the status of the lethal drugs is also unknown. Now let's think about this. Some of those 27 might have died by assisted suicide. Some of them didn't. Some of them, where's the lethal drugs? Is this a good idea to have lethal drugs sitting around? Do you like that idea? Do you feel safe about that idea? Having lethal drugs just sitting around? No. Does that seem smart? How safe it is to, for people to have... And this is how the law works. They say, oh, we'll have effective oversight, Alex. Everything will be fine. Don't worry about it. Well, let's see about this whole thing about psychiatric issues. It's very important for depression issues. In 2008, Linda Ganzini, who's pro-assisted suicide, she's not on her side. She did a study. 58 people who had asked for assisted suicide joined her study. And out of the 58, 15 of them were depressed, or as she said, were experiencing extreme feelings of hopelessness. So you would think that, according to this study, now some studies show higher numbers, right? Is it uncommon for people who are terminally ill or have a significant health condition to be depressed? Is that uncommon? Or is that normal? I think that's sort of normal. I think that's a human reality. If I'm sick, I'm very sick, I might be depressed too. Why would I be depressed? Because it's natural. I'll be emotionally distraught about my human condition. Well, if 26%, how come only 5 of the 132 were sent for a psychiatric evaluation? Are people who are depressed dying by assisted suicide? How come only 2% in the last 5 years have been sent for psychiatric evaluations? Is it because Ganzini's study was wrong? Well, look at this study out of the Netherlands, 2005 study by Dr. Vanderdy. Now, why it's important about this study? Dr. Vanderdy was very pro-euthanasia. If you read the study, you see in her preamble, she's trying to prove that depression and euthanasia are not connected. That's what she's trying to prove. She's trying to prove that there's no counter connection. And what did she actually find in her study? She found, to our surprise, we found that a depressed mood was associated with more requests. Patients with a depressed mood had a 4 times greater risk of requesting assisted suicide or euthanasia. Now think about this. If you look at the data in her study, it actually shows that almost nobody who wasn't depressed asked for euthanasia. But people who were depressed were very likely to ask for euthanasia. She concludes that depression is a primary risk factor for euthanasia. So what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with people who are at a very terrible time of their life. They're going through a physical condition often, not always. They're very emotionally affected by this. They're emotionally down. And now they're asking to have their life ended. Why are they asking to have their life ended? Because they feel there's no hope. They've lost hope. They have no hope for their future. They feel that their life has lost value. That's what they're feeling. And they're asking to have their life ended. Is this about freedom of choice? Is this about autonomy? Is this about my freedoms? I'm going to quickly show you some Belgium data, because this is how bad it can get. There isn't a clock in my thing here, so I'm trying to see what time it is. I'm causing you difficulties. I don't know. Pardon? Oh, we're good. Okay, this is good. So let's have a little... It's right here. I didn't see it because the screen was here. Sorry about that. I'm being difficult. So the Belgium study came out in March of 2015. And this Belgium study examined 3,751 deaths. Now let me explain to you the importance of this study. You may say, why do I need to know about a Belgium study? Well, I already explained to you how the law works. In every jurisdiction where it's legal, 2 doctors must agree. The doctor who kills you sends in the report. And then all the other side keeps saying, if you look at the research from the other side, they're always saying, You know, that Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, those types, they're just trying to scare you. There's no real sign of abuse of the law. Well, because doctors don't self-report abuse of the law. Right? When you're driving down the highway, driving way too fast, do you get out your cell phone, which is also illegal to do, and call the police saying, come pick me up, I'm speeding? No, you don't do that. Do doctors self-report when they break the law? No, they don't. So you find out in the reports, nothing. What do you find out in the what does the Oregon report tell you? Other than the Washington State report told you, actually, quite a few deaths happen that they've got no data on. They just don't know anything about it. Well, that's pretty concerning. So this is a death study. They looked at all deaths, right? They looked at a whole subset of deaths. They weren't looking at euthanasia. It was all deaths. So if you died of a heart attack, it would show you died of a heart attack. If you died by euthanasia, it would show what? You died of euthanasia. And what did that report show us? It showed us that 4.6% of all the deaths were euthanasia. That's a lot, actually. It's very high. It showed you that 1.7% of all the deaths were hastened without request. And this is not the first study that Belgium's done this way. They did the same study in 2007, and it showed 1.8%. So, in fact, the data hasn't changed in 6 years. So what does that mean? That meant in 2013, in the Flanders region of Belgium, it meant that over 1,000 people were killed, intentionally killed, doctor did it, intentionally killed them, without any request. That's what that means. But look at Washington State. They said, well, there's 27 deaths that we don't know if they died of assisted suicide or not. We have no information about it. Well, if you look at the data out of Belgium, it shows you about half the deaths aren't even reported. About half. A little less than half aren't reported. Now, what's important about that is the law requires the doctor, after they kill you, to send in a report. A lot of the doctors just don't bother. They don't bother sending in a report. They killed you, but they're not going to bother sending in a report. Why don't they send in a report? Because, you know, maybe there were some gray areas. Maybe they just don't bother. Maybe they're too lazy. Maybe they just don't believe in sending in reports. There's good lots of reasons for it. A similar study was done of nurses. They did a study in 2007. It was published in 2010, where they asked, sent questionnaires to nurses. 1,265 nurses responded, 248 nurses of the last said that the last patient who died in their care who had died of euthanasia, and 120 of those, they said it was done without request. Massive numbers. Do the reports say that? No. You have to do other studies, death studies, other questions to find the abuse of the law. Why? Because the law is designed for what? The law is designed to protect the doctor. Anytime you have a situation where the doctor will decide, the doctor will do it, and the doctor will report it, means the law is designed to protect the doctor. The law is not designed to protect someone who might be going through a vulnerable condition. And let's go one step further. It makes sense that they did that, compassion and choices in the euthanasia lobby. Why does it make sense they did that? Would a doctor want to give you a lethal dose if they had any fear that they might be prosecuted, that they might be sued, they might have some repercussion? Would they want to start giving you a lethal dose if they had some worry that something bad might happen to them for doing it? No. They needed a law to protect doctors so the doctor would have no fear in being involved in killing you. That's what the law's about. I'm going to jump past that. Here's a story that came out of Netherlands last year. This story was a very interesting story. It really shocked me because I have an autistic son. My son Peter's 20. He goes to college. No one thought he would ever go to college. He goes to college. And so when I saw this story out of Netherlands, it shocked me. Why? A physically healthy, 63-year-old man, he's worked all his life for the government. Government job. I know something about autism. If he had a job that he knew well, he was probably totally committed to it. I'm sure he worked very hard. Okay? He has no friends. He never got married. No family. Now he's retiring, and he says, I'm alone, I'm depressed, I want to die. The euthanasia clinic did what? They killed him. Think about this. What did this man need? Did this man need death? Is this what this man needed? Or did this man need a friend? What did this man need? A friend, absolutely. Now, he's autistic, so he might have had a hard time being friends. It might have been harder on him to be a friend. He would have needed someone to go out of the way to try and be friendly. He needed a reason to live, right? He had lost hope in his life. He had given his life to his work. That's what his focus was. Everything about him was his work. And now, he wants to die. This is about a feeling of hopelessness. People aren't saying, oh, I want to die because of my freedom. It's my freedom. I want to die. I want to exercise my freedom. Are they saying that? No. No, that's not about that. It's because they're down. They're emotionally distraught. They're going through a there's very few radical autonomists out there, because there's a few of them. You hear them say to you, oh, you know, it's my body, my choice. I should be able to decide. No, most people, it's because they're emotionally going through a tough time in their life. Right? They need a friend. They're down. They're alone. They're lonely. That's what's going on. So in November 2013, I was in... we launched our EPC Europe, the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition Europe was launched. And this Dr. Jan Bernheim, he agreed to debate me in Belgium. It's very interesting. He was one of the gurus, the early promoters of euthanasia. He's very proud of the Belgium euthanasia law, and he was one of the main, you know, people promoting it in its early years. Anyway, so I debated Dr. Jan Bernheim, and there was about 200 people there. People say, oh, this is a dead issue in Belgium. No one was going to come out. We had about 200 people out. Most of them were in favor. And Dr. Bernheim went first, and he explained, we've eliminated all suffering in Belgium. That was his story for them. He went through, he talked about, you know, people in Belgium, they don't suffer anymore. Suffering is gone. We have nirvana. Suffering is over because we have euthanasia. And how wonderful this was, he was talking about. And then I got up there, and what did I do? I went through all the stories in Belgium, the data from Belgium. I explained all the data. I explained how you had deaths of people without requests going on, and I showed the data clearly. You have nurses doing it, even though the law doesn't allow it. You have deaths of people who are incompetent. You have all these things going on. You've got abuse of the law. I talked about a couple of the stories, and I sat down. And what did Dr. Bernheim do? He goes up to the microphone, because he got to respond to me, and he says... This is how he starts. There are problems with the Belgian euthanasia law. That's what he said. And my microphone was on, and I said, that's cold comfort for the dead. Cold comfort for the dead. They're talking about this as being freedom of choice and autonomy. Well, you know, the fact of it is yes, we need to do more for people who are going through difficult circumstances. That's absolutely correct. It's not right of a culture that we're abandoning people who are going through difficult times in their life. And a lot of people are feeling abandoned in our culture. We have a problem with abandonment and loneliness in our culture. That's absolutely correct. And we have to become far more caring and reaching out and being with others, visiting the people who are going through a difficult time. We have to recognize that if assisted suicide were to become legal here, that we're going to need to become that caring other for the others who are feeling their life has lost value. Why do they feel their life has lost value? Yes, they're going through a difficult time. There's no question about it. There's a lot of difficult conditions to live with in life. But you know, if you're going to have a difficult condition that you're living with, and you're doing it alone, and you're lonely, that's a hard place to be. It's a very hard place to be. So we must recognize that there is a difficulty in our culture. Absolutely. Our culture's become too me-oriented. It's about me. Not Alex. No. I mean, about me. We're all about me. By becoming about me, we have abandoned the other. And this is what's feeding. It's feeding the assisted suicide culture, because why? People are thinking, I don't want to be a burden on others. I'm afraid of suffering, they say. I'm afraid of suffering. Well, I don't want to suffer. I don't want to suffer. But the fact of it is we don't need to suffer like that. And on top of it, suffering alone is really the greatest problem we have. A lot of people suffer alone. Well, what are they really saying when they're looking at assisted suicide and euthanasia? They're saying, you know, I'm not sure if I actually support this. That's what most Americans are saying. I'm not sure if I support that or not, but I'm concerned about how I die in the future. And that's a reality. It's a truth. That's how they feel. But it's not about their choice. It's not about their autonomy. It's about the choice and the autonomy of somebody else. I'm going to jump past that data. You don't need to know more about the Netherlands. It's enough. What about my friend Mark Pickup? How many of you heard of Mark Pickup before? Have you got the video queued up? Can you get it? Perfect. So in 1 second, I'm going to go to that. So Mark Pickup is in Edmonton, and he talks about how, many of you might have heard of him before, in 1985, he was a healthy man, he was a vibrant man, a family man, he's still a family man, but what happened is MS came upon him, and it was a shock to him. And he said, if assisted suicide were legal then, I would have chosen it. Or I certainly would have thought I wanted it. Because he was down. He was down. He was really emotionally distraught. And that's a normal human reality. This is not about weird people. This is about people going through a normal human reality and a feeling that their life has lost hope. They might not have any faith, which even makes the situation worse. And now they're wanting their life to end. Well, Mark says, you know, I needed a time to mourn. I needed a time to accept that Mark has changed. In my MS, I'm going to be in a wheelchair, and my life has changed. But my life can still be good. And his life is good. He's happy. But most people never allow that. And if you allow assisted suicide, there's no opportunity to go from the mourning to the other side of being happy with who you are. Because you killed yourself or someone killed you when you were down. That's what it's about. And remember, it's about somebody else killing you. That's what it's about. They're directly and intentionally agreeing. What makes it even worse, when you go visit a doctor and ask for assisted suicide, you might be very down. That's correct. Someone might be very down. But the doctor's saying, I agree with you. Your life's not worth living. And they respond by giving you a lethal dose. And in my country, they're going to respond by giving them a lethal injection. It's a very horrific thing. And it's a very disturbing way of dealing with people who need good care and good help and a loving community. That is a response to this. So what happened is we recently produced a video, and it's being produced. It's not out yet, and so the promo for it is going to come up. So what happened is, you know, I've been doing a lot of talks, and I talked to a good friend of mine who's a professional film producer, has done a lot of documentaries, and I said to him, well, let's try and get a video out. Let's try and get it out nice and easy and quick. I said, you know, you film me doing a talk, and then we're going to do a bunch of interviews with other people. So we'll have all these interviews. We have my talk. We're going to build a video that's not talking head, right? And we'll put it out nice and quick. It'll be like a training video for others. And so we started, and he interviewed a bunch of people. He did the videoing of me doing my presentation before a group of people. And he says, Alex, we've got to go to the belly of the beast, he said. We've got to go to Belgium. And I said, Kevin, I have a lot of contacts in Belgium. I've did the debate in Belgium. I'm working with people in Belgium. I said, we can do that. So in January, he spent a week in Belgium. He interviewed 14 people who have direct life experience with euthanasia. A mother who died, you know, family members who died, grandfather died by euthanasia. And they talk about their stories, and he interviewed them all because he wanted to show you the belly of the beast. You got to know what's going on if you're going to. And anyway, have that feeling of strength in your heart. I got to fight this. And so you're going to see the promo for it. The promo's out. The video won't come out till June. And he's going to click it in for us. It's about 4 minutes.
On April 19th, 2012, my mother receives a lethal injection in the hospital of the Free University in Brussels.
But you had no idea?
No.
My granddad developed non-Hodgkin's lymph cancer at roughly 80 years of age. He was basically killed by the medical staff in the care home.
My mother was physically healthy. I mean, she was, yes, indeed. She was going in and out of depressions all her life, but is there a reason for it in Asia? Apparently it is.
We had a few times when the people tried to put us under pressure to have her euthanized. She's just a child like every other child in our family.
So my mother, instead of going for the palliative treatment, she said, I want euthanasia. Had there been no euthanasia in Belgium, she would not have applied, for sure.
I think it's impossible to put safeguards, because it's also impossible to know what is a terminally ill situation. In Belgium, patients are killed by euthanasia at the first diagnosis of Alzheimer or of a malignant disease of a cancer. From all the cases, only 60 to 70% were declared to the commission. So this means that 30 to 40% of the cases of euthanasia are even not declared, and there is no control of the law.
She was the one going to die, but we were her sons, we loved her, and we wanted the best for her.
Was there a consensus?
There was not a consensus.
As a mother, it wasn't only her quality of life, it was also the quality of life of her own grandchildren.
Well, the law says that nobody has to be aware of the demand of the patient. It's only the patient who will decide. It is strange because at the same time, they don't respect the autonomy of doctors who want to not do euthanasia, and they even don't respect the autonomy of institutions who don't want to choose for euthanasia.
An aunt of mine was visiting him, and she was giving him some water, and one of the nursing staff came by and said to her, "Don't do that, you're prolonging the process of his dying." And she said, "What?"
You see, once you're dead, you're dead. So there's no chance of changing your mind. That's the finality of this. You must understand that this issue is not like any other.
I regret my mother had a treatment on that level. I think she and all the other people dying deserve more. We owe it to them.
This is a worldwide issue. This is an issue now that is being debated in nearly every country in the world, and there's pressure in almost all jurisdictions of the world to legalize doctors killing their patients.
We help people to die, controlling their suffering and controlling their symptoms. We don't help them to die by killing them.
What is our society becoming? It's a quality society. Only the best will survive.
Now, I want you to know that the theme is sort of similar to my talk, even though maybe I didn't hit the point perfectly, but this is all about a lie. Euthanasia, assisted suicide, is about a lie. It's not about my body, my choice. It's about the doctor having the right and law to cause my death. When you legalize assisted suicide, you give power to your doctor over your life. That's what you're doing. And the fact of it is, that no one should have the power over your life and death. They shouldn't have that. And you can't control it. It's not possible to control it. In the end, there will be many reasons why someone might ask for it. That's a normal human reality. They say, "Oh, well, we're going to legalize euthanasia, assisted suicide, and that's going to give me the right to ask for my life and my control, right? It's about my control." It doesn't. People already ask. Where it's illegal, people already ask at times because they might be hopeless. They might say to a doctor, "Can you end my life?" I'm not saying it's common, but they might ask for that still. So nothing's changed there. What's changed when you legalize it is the doctor can now actually cause your death. That's what's changed. The doctor having the power over your life and death. It's not a safe thing. It's not a good idea in any way, shape, or form. And it really devalues things. One other thing I want to say is it started in Quebec just on December the 10th. December 10th. We just had a presentation in Ottawa to members of Parliament, and we had a palliative care doctor there with us. And he's only been a palliative care doctor for 6 years, but for almost that whole time, of course, euthanasia has been illegal. He said, "In all those years, I had 3 requests for someone to end their life, to ask me to end their life. 3 requests, he said. Since December 10th, half of my patients, the law changed on December 10th in Quebec, right? Half of my patients have asked me now, half of them since December 10th. I had 3 requests up to December 10th. Post, I've had half. Why? Well, because the cultural pressure now has changed, hasn't it? It goes very fast, very, very fast. So are there any questions? Yes, sir, you got questions. Now, if they're about Tim Hortons coffee, yeah, Canadians like Tim Hortons coffee. There's something in it that's addictive. There really is. And it's not just the caffeine. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. We'll do a handoff system. Because half the questions seem to be medical, half of them are legal. But just start with it from the doctor's perspective. What about the Hippocratic Oath of doing no harm? How would you...
Is this mic working? Yeah. The Hippocratic Oath issue is not an issue because the Hippocratic Oath doesn't exist anymore. So, you know, some doctors who are Christians will take a Hippocratic Oath, but it's not because their university is having them do that. You might have some Christian medical school in the United States. We don't have that in Canada anymore, and there is no such thing as a Hippocratic Oath. In fact, the other side has, I got to watch my French, has redefined do no harm as meaning you have to do euthanasia or assisted suicide because you're harming the patient by not killing them when they're suffering. Because to them, the ultimate evil is what? Suffering. Yeah. Now, suffering is not dealt with by killing you. Suffering is dealt with by caring for your pain, caring for your symptoms. But you know, the most important thing we have to do is care for you. If you're suffering alone, I guarantee you it's going to be a very hard time. I know that. People who suffer alone, it's very hard. If you're suffering with others caring for you, who are others being with you, others who love you, and you feel your life has value, your suffering is usually a lot less than. Not because of your physical pain, but because others care for you enough that you feel your life has value. Yeah, go on.
You know, the next one's a little more economic in nature, but your system, socialized health, yeah. Is there a financial benefit? Is there more pressure because you're socialized? Or are they neutral?
The answer is yes. Next question. Of course. If we have universal health care in Canada and it's a one-payer system, then obviously if we kill you, it's a lot cheaper. Next.
Right. Wow, I like simplistic. Okay. Okay, let's go to the prevention. Your work is prevention, so what's the best way we can stop this from spreading?
Well, first of all, it's not legal here in your state here. It is legal in Vermont, which isn't that far away. There's going to be pressure to legalize. You might get your pressure next year. It might be 2018. Next year, Compassionate Choices has decided they're going to go all out. Next year, there's going to be an assault on this nation to legalize assisted suicide. We are still very concerned this year about New York, because New York, we're not sure if it's going to fall or not. If it does, that would be a tragedy. We hope it doesn't, but New York, there's a lot of pressure this year. They're putting a lot of money into New York right now to try and get New York this year. But I hope they don't succeed, obviously. You're going to be shocked by the wave next year coming at us, and the only way to stop it is to tell the truth. This is not about your body, your choice. This is not about your autonomy. This is about your doctor having the right to kill you. People will die without request. On top of it, elder abuse is a massive issue. How can you prove to me that these people are actually wanting to die? Give me a break. And how do we deal with people? Do we kill our most vulnerable? You know, let's think about this. And, you know, just think about going further. Right now, there's a big push also. I'm a Catholic. There's a big push amongst Catholics that we should just oppose capital punishment. Why? Well, lots of good reasons for that. But obviously, one reason is there might be someone who didn't commit a crime who we killed, right? Well, there could be people who are just simply depressed, who needed care, good care, and they're dying. We're lethally injecting them, or we're giving them lethal doses. That's craziness. That's abandonment. Thank you very much. Next.
Okay. And the three are kind of combined. We'll make this our last one as the clock just ticked down. So for those of us, so I get looking around, a lot of us are caring for aging parents. Doctors and people sharing, you know, hey, the quality of life issue, and what should they be doing, or what will we face as we're caring for aging parents?
Okay, so the difficulty today is that there's a cultural shift that's happened, whether we like it or not. The shift has already happened. There used to be an ethic in our medical culture that we cared for people, and you care for people at all times, and now that has shifted. And that doesn't mean all our physicians have shifted their mentality, but the system itself has shifted. So in some places, you'll find that the culture of the medical institution has shifted so much that there's pressure on you just not to do anything for mom. Or just, you know, just... And what we know is we know how it should be. How it should be is we do what is best for that person, right? We do what's best for that person. If there's something that's beneficial for them, we urge that. So you have to all understand a little bit about these issues and be willing to become not only the caregiver, but the person who speaks out for them. If you're an elderly person, let's say you talked about a mother. Let's say you're the caregiver for your mother, or you're the representative for your mother. Don't let your mother go for a major medical meeting without having caregiving people around them. Because, you know, when someone loves you and they're beside you saying how important mom is to us, they look at mom differently, okay? And I'm going to tell you one other thing. We have to get out there and become the other side. And in our work, we've started this thing called Compassionate Community Care. So we have a helpline so people can call if they have an issue, they're concerned that the doctor's pressuring you to do something you think is inappropriate, or you're concerned that something's happening that's inappropriate, as well as there's lots of issues that they call about and ask questions about. So we're offering that, but we're also urging people, okay, if they're going to impose euthanasia on us, then you better be there visiting with, caring for, spending time with your loved ones. The only safeguard we have is a caring person who's willing to stand up and say, I know my mom's important to me. We're not doing this. Thank you very much. Okay? That's important. And you have to speak always lovingly, because you know the other side is just going to say, oh, that's that freaky person. We're going to ignore them. No, you have to be straightforward, but loving and caring. But that's how we have to be. And then the one other thing that's so important in the culture today is that we have to recognize that because the world's changed, how do you protect the other? Well, the battles we have to fight are several. One is that this can never become legal. You can't allow this to become legal. And someday in the future, if I'm here and your state did legalize it, and it would be a very sad situation, then the big thing is, how do we protect people in such a culture? And the only way you can protect them is by you being with them, caring for them, and setting up this way of making sure that people are not going through these situations alone, because then they become vulnerable. Vulnerability is not being in a wheelchair, as much as that might be a vulnerability. Vulnerability is being alone and lonely in a culture that doesn't respect your life. That's vulnerability. We're all going to be there someday, thank you very much. Assisted suicide threatens all of your lives, even if you think, oh, that wouldn't affect me, but I understand it's important. No, it affects all of your lives, because you're dealing with somebody else having the power over your life. That's pretty scary. And you're all going to feel down at times. Some of us will become very down. Some of us are going to go through that deep, dark time of our soul and our life. Some of us are going to experience that. And when we do, we might ask for something that we would have never otherwise thought about asking for. Is the answer to that to abandon them to death? Or is the answer to say, no, we're not doing that to you? So you need your doctor to have the right to say no. You also need to have people who care about you. And you have to recognize that. We have to recognize the importance of the fact that as a human being, we are emotional, we're psychological, we're spiritual, we're physical, and we're all intertwined. We're not just, you know, dualistic or multi. We're a unified being. And in that nature, we need to care for the other. Okay? You have to recognize that's so important. And it's sad that some people don't have family anymore. You know, that's very sad.
That was just awesome. In one of the most difficult subjects ever, you made it interesting, informing, and even a little humorous. But thank you for being there, and thank you for being with us. Wow.
You have been listening to Alex Schadenberg, the Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, and a 2016 Bringing America Back to Life Convention presenter.